A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Not Another Mummy Podcast with me, Alison Perry. My guest today had always dreamed of being a mum, but at age 37 and very much single with no partner on the horizon, she decided to take matters into her own hands. Liv Thorne started researching sperm banks and fertility clinics, setting out on a journey that resulted in her being a solo mum to 3-year-old Herb today. Her book, Lives Alone, is a warm and hopeful memoir, and it dismantles the fairy tale that we're all fed from a young age and shows an alternative route to motherhood via buying sperm from Denmark. Welcome to the podcast, Liv. How are you doing and what has your day been like so far?
Thank you. Hello. So far, it's really cold today, actually. Suddenly it's a bit frosty.
It's turned, hasn't it?
It's turned. And the boy, Herb, I just took him to school and came back and I'm now in my office just about to set up to do a day's work.
Excellent.
You know, standard. Nothing fun. It's only 10 o'clock in the morning.
It is, to be fair.
You know,
I ask you that question
yet.
like you've done loads. Like, well, today...
Yeah, I've managed to get up and get the kid to school. That'll do me. I'm done.
Funny, but that's an achievement.
Yeah, I'm here for it.
Excellent. Now, you've spoken about how you've always wanted to be a mum, and you've written a whole book about it, clearly.
I have written a whole book about it.
And I want to know from you, what is the earliest point that you can remember knowing that motherhood was something that felt right for you? Because obviously that feeling doesn't happen for everybody as an adult, never mind in younger years.
It's really funny, isn't it? Because I just assumed that all women felt like that, that they'd all grown up being like, oh, yeah, I want to be a mum. And actually, I've learned that loads of women are just like, oh, God, no. And then that feeling sort of comes as they get older, you know, so they hit their 30s
or whatever.
Or it doesn't. Yeah, yeah. I've met many women who have sort of said, God, you've really put my mind at ease that I definitely don't want kids because I've never had any of the feelings you're talking about, you know. But I, from a really young age, Alison, like I'd say from maybe 12 or 13, because my brothers and sisters are much older than I am. And so when I was 12, my sister had her first baby. And from then we've had a baby kind of every 2 years in our family, at least minimum. There are just hundreds. And so I think when it's something that's constantly surrounding you, and like I'm from a big family, I'm one of four. And like I say, my brothers and sisters have all got at least 3 children each. And my friends all started it happened that my friends all got together with their partners in their early 20s. And a lot of them had kids by the time they were 26, 27, 28. And so again, there was another sort of influx of children. So knowing I wanted children started from, like I say, maybe 12. And then it just kept being reinforced every time someone had a baby. Like I was one of those people that got really high pitched and squeaky whenever there was a child near. Less so now I've had one.
Yes, funny that.
But yeah, I did. I was very. I'm a bit like that with dogs now. I just get this kind of rush that I need to go and hug them.
Yeah. Are you that strange person in the park who just rushes up to strange dogs?
Yes, I am. And I don't talk to the owner at all. Well, I sort of say, hi, can I touch your dog? And then I'm not talking to the owner at all. I'm just awkwardly loving their dog as they're trying to walk on and get about their day. Yeah, I am that person.
And you've said that when you were younger, all of your friends reckoned you'd grow up to be Pippa Ross, the foster mum in Home and Away.
Yeah.
As an aside, can we just talk about how weird it was when Pippa was, she woke up one day and she'd been like blonde. She was blonde with curly blonde hair. And then she woke up one day and she was brunette.
Redhead. Yeah. Curly. Yeah. Amazing. That's my favourite Pippa. The second Pippa is my favourite Pippa.
I just don't think I ever got over it. I think I will always be an original Pippa fan.
Oh, no, I'm the second Pippa and I don't know why. I'm obsessed with Home and Away. So you need to stop me because I will. I don't have a cool bone in my body. And that is denoted by the fact that I have watched Home and Away every day since it first started.
Are you still watching it?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Absolutely.
Respect.
Yeah. It's like my 17 minutes of vitamin D a day where you just don't think of anything. You just look at all these pretty people having ridiculous dramas.
I love it. I love it. So everyone thought that you were going to grow up to be Pippa Ross, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think, again, because I was really comfortable around kids because they'd always been in my life. And I'd be the person also, like at uni, I was the person that had a car. So I took the girls if they needed to go to a hospital appointment or if they were really boozed and they needed picking up from some random alley in, you know, outside a club because they couldn't find a taxi. It was always me people called because I was a safe pair of hands, basically. I think that it came about in my university handbook that I was most likely to be Pippa Ross because, I was just constantly surrounded by people asking for advice or me helping them. Not in a kind of, Jesus, I wasn't being a martyr. I loved it.
Sounds like you were very maternal.
Really maternal, I think. But in a kind of quite natural way rather than me forcing.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm one of those people that has a face that everyone sits next to on the bus. You know, if I'm sat on a bus, there will not be a spare seat next to me. They will come and sit next to me and all of a sudden talking to me about their life stories. And that's always been the case. And I always want to help people. I don't know. It's just innate, I think, isn't it?
It's lovely. Kind of it's lovely. And in your book, you share a brilliant description of the fantasies that you had of meeting a wonderful man, moving in together, him popping the question, a country wedding, and then sharing the news of your pregnancy. But the reason that you haven't ever met someone, as far as you know, as far as you're
aware,
allowed someone into your life that way, is actually pretty heartbreaking. And the way that you describe it in your book had me in tears. I was sat in the gym cafe reading it, just hoping that no one could see me, kind of like wiping the tears away from my cheeks. But for anyone who hasn't read your book, tell us what happened.
So, I mean, this is all very my own sort of self-psychology. So this may not be actually what's up, but in my head, my parents died when I was quite young. So my mum got breast cancer when I was 8. And she went through quite a lot of treatment and then she got the all clear. And then my dad was diagnosed with asbestos poisoning, essentially, which it sort of manifests itself as lung cancer, really. And he died when I was 12. And then after he died, mum got poorly again and she died when I was 17. So I spent from the age of sort of 8 to 17 having people poorly or dying around, when I say people, my parents. And then after that, my grandparents died quite early. It wasn't until I was maybe early 30s that I realised the reason I'd never been in a relationship, I think, is because I didn't want people to get near me, because if I let them in, they could leave me and break my heart again, like when my parents died, because obviously that the trauma that left me as a child and a teenager, I hadn't really ever acknowledged, I think acknowledged is the right word. And then I obviously, like everyone else, I had two sort of first loves that totally broke my heart. And it was after the second one, when I was about 21, that I was like, no, I'm not doing that again. I'm not putting myself through heartbreak again. It's just not happening. And it's the fear of abandonment, I think, because obviously things just kept changing throughout my childhood so much. People just weren't dying. And which is obviously quite finite, and the grief that leaves. But I hadn't realised, like I say, until, well, really recently, how much that had affected me. I totally thought I was fine about it all. And I am. I mean, obviously I'm fine. But I didn't realise the scarring it had left on me as a person. And therefore, I would never go out on a second date, because if I went out on a second date, it may go well and then I may fall in love and heaven forbid they may hurt me, or I'd deliberately fall for people I knew I had no chance with, or, you know, because again, then it couldn't go anywhere because it was never going to start and therefore I couldn't get hurt. But the fear of being hurt and brokenhearted just was my top fear. Like I couldn't bear to go through that again, for anyone to leave me again. So I didn't put myself in a position where they could get near me enough for me to care whether they left me.
And have you ever had therapy about this? Because it sounds like the kind of thing that actually digging a bit deeper and dealing with that trauma from your teen years might really help you.
Be good. I know. I think I say in my book that I asked my sisters if I'd ever had therapy, and they said, yeah, Liv, of course, at Mum's Hospice. We were amazing. They had a therapist there for kids and relatives of the people in the hospice. And I convinced them that I was fine. So I think I had one session, convinced them I was fine. And I've sort of been doing that ever since. And so I have had therapy on and off, but again, I was a bit too scared to go there.
Mm. Oh my goodness, it's terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely terrifying. And I just hate being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So that's, again, the book was actually quite therapeutic.
I bet it was.
Not enough. I mean, I'm very aware I need more.
Yeah. I think you do. And I say that as somebody who's recently started having therapy.
Yeah,
and
I know.
The whole point
absolutely.
Of it is that you have to delve into that really uncomfortable place in order to heal from that trauma.
Get out the other side.
But it's a really massive step to make, because...
And it's also finding the right therapist. Like I've had a few and they're just... I've never found the right one, and you've really got to find the right one, especially for this level of therapy that I need. So yeah, I need to get on it. I really do. I know I do.
Do it. Write it down on your to-do list.
Yes, which is in front of me.
I know you're good at researching stuff, Liv, because you research sperm donors and the whole thing really well. So this is your next project. Going back to how you were feeling back then, you've mentioned that lots of your friends, settled down and got married and started having babies in their 20s. What was that like for you? Because you said in the book that it was like having the countdown clock permanently ticking your mind, that you were aware of, your own fertility, that horrible clock. It must have been pretty hard to be seeing your friends having babies when you knew that it was all that you wanted.
It was at the beginning, in our 20s when it happened, it was just exciting that my friends were living that life, because I was in my 20s and you have that really beautiful kind of... blind faith that everything will be how you picture it. And so in my 20s I was like, oh my god, it's lovely, because that'll be me soon walking down the aisle and having a baby and la la la. And it just So at the beginning, it was just exciting. And then after a while, it got tougher and tougher until the point that every time someone told me that they were pregnant, I made it about me in my head, not to them, obviously, but I couldn't hear them say, I'm pregnant. All I could hear was me going, I'm not pregnant, I'm not pregnant, I'm not pregnant. You know, that kind of anxiety and loneliness makes you really selfish. And your thoughts are completely about you, which is really shitty. And you don't want it to be. And you're fighting that because you're thrilled your friends are having babies, really. But all you can think about is the fact that you're not. And yeah, that's really tough. It got tougher the older I got, obviously, because the dreams of how I thought life was going to be were clearly ebbing away, which was making everything a bit trickier to sort of navigate in my head.
And when did the idea first come to you that you could have a baby without meeting a man first?
Well, I always joked about it from quite early on, in my late 20s, I think. About sperm donors and turkey basting, and wouldn't it be hilarious? And then suddenly I was like, oh shit, actually, that's probably something I'm going to have to do. And then year on year, it became obvious that actually that was going to... I mean, there were no men in my life. It wasn't even that I was, because of my fear of abandonment, that I was, you know, leaving a trail of devastated men in my wake. There just weren't any.
To be fair, that was probably because you were so closed off to the idea. I mean, all those men probably were really, like, not going to go near, not going near her. She's clearly not up for any kind of conversation.
Yeah, maybe. I'd like to think that, but I'm not sure that's true. So it just became more and more likely that I had to look for another route to motherhood, to making my dreams come true, because doing it the quote-unquote normal way wasn't happening. It wasn't something that was looking likely. And so I needed to take it into my own hands and do it for myself, as it were.
And you were quite nervous telling your family, weren't you?
Yeah. I was so nervous because... again, they probably had assumed, like I had, what my life would be like. And I knew, everyone knew I wanted a baby. I mean, we didn't talk about it, but it was bloody obvious. And they know me the best in the world, my siblings. And had one of them sort of said, oh, really? You know, that would have made me think, shit, maybe I can't do this. You know, maybe that is just a ridiculous idea. And so I was really nervous about telling them in case they made me disbelieve myself and the fact that I could do it or should do it. And the opposite was true. They were super supportive immediately and, like, almost sort of breathing a sigh of relief of course you should, like, come on, let's go. And they, you know, there were, that's not to say they didn't have some concerns, but ultimately they were the same concerns I had, and that anyone that going into parenting, whether you're single or not, have, you know, like, Jesus, is now the right time, can I do it on my own, you know. But ultimately they were amazing.
You said that your brother was really uncomfortable with the discussion of sperm.
Yeah, all men are. It's really weird. I think because as women we have to know our bodies so much better, and just with periods and stuff that happen.
Like bodily fluids or just something regularly. That is just there.
Happen.
Yeah.
And especially now people talk about it more and more, but men don't have that really. And so if you talk to most men about sperm or sperm donation, they get a bit giggly or like, no, you know, this kind of, oh yes, and because they've never thought about it, and you're making them think of things they've never thought about. Whereas with women, like you say, bodily functions is just how our life rolls, so we just don't care about talking about things like that as much. So my brother, bless him, was thrilled. He was so supportive. He just didn't want to know much about the
the ins and outs.
Yeah, the actual intricacies. Yeah, yeah, the intricacies of it. He just wanted facts yeah. and knowledge and, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas I was going, oh, I might be getting some sperm from Denmark. He's like,
And how did you even begin working out how much money you would need? Because it's not just the fertility treatment. And you don't know how much fertility treatment you're going to need. But it's also, as you've already mentioned, you know, the cost of raising a baby on your own.
Yeah. Well, the cost of raising a baby on my own is something I did not look into enough. But actually, I'm kind of glad I didn't, because had I have looked into childcare costs...
Oh, don't even start me on childcare costs.
Yeah, I would have talked myself out of having a baby, and then I wouldn't have Herb. And so I'm kind of glad I was a bit gung-ho. And in terms of fertility costs, I, again, had no idea, because you don't know... At the start, you don't know if you've got any fertility issues or how long things could go on for. So I just had to give myself a limit of how many times that I would let myself go through treatment. And if it didn't happen by then, I'd have to reassess and look into other options. Or because I'm really, what's the word? Abundant in everything. And so, and I'm not good at saying no, or, you know, I'm the person that if you come for supper, there's food for 900 people and all that sort of stuff. And so I had to give myself a limit, because otherwise I'd have kept going and I'd have been 65, still trying, because that is how my life is inclined to do. You know, I just keep going. So I had no idea on costs, but I remortgaged my house. I was really lucky I had a house to remortgage. Fertility is a really, really, really privileged thing to be able to do if you have to pay for it yourself. And the NHS, look, it's a real hot potato, but yeah, it's postcode lottery whether you can have fertility treatment in the UK or in England. Sorry, I don't know about Wales, Scotland, and Ireland, as a single person.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I don't know the ins and outs of it, because it makes me a bit sad. So I haven't looked into it. And I, again, which is another thing I'm really good at, is I buried my head in the sand about it, because I didn't want to go down the route of thinking that the NHS may be able to help me. And then them say no. And so me have to find finances elsewhere. So I cut that out of the equation. And I was really, really bloody lucky that I could do that.
And you do talk about privilege in the book. You do you do acknowledge the fact that this is your story, this is your experience, but you're not kind of, you know, standing up and saying, hey, everyone who's single, who wants a baby, this is what you should do.
No, not at all. I'm not an expert in this. I'm an expert in how I did it. And there are loads of things I'd have done differently now. But, being able to remortgage a house that I own in order to get what I want is the most privileged thing anyone can say. Do you know what I mean? And the fact that I could go to a sperm bank and find a donor that was likely to look quite like me, again, really privileged thing to be able to do. And so I have to always acknowledge that, because there are people in my position that don't have that, you know, that would need the NHS's support or get sperm donors from Facebook, which again, I totally understand. You know, if I didn't have the money to do it, I'd have looked everywhere else too. Because if it's something you want that badly, you look anywhere to get it, to do it. And so, yeah, what I did and how I did it, I was so privileged, and I know that, and I'm bloody lucky and really grateful. Although, I mean, that privilege came with a lot of other things, you know, like the reason I owned my house is because my parents died. So there's that. Being a single woman at 35 in Oxford, owning a house would not have been happening if my parents hadn't have left me some money when I was a teenager. I wouldn't have been able to afford a house. No questions asked. So yeah, it's you know, life's different for everyone, isn't it?
It is.
It's a frigging roller coaster.
It really is. Now tell me about the process that you went through to find the sperm donor, because as you've mentioned, you went to Denmark. And didn't you, wasn't it?
I went to a website in Denmark.
Anyway, yes, of course, you didn't travel. I have these visions of you jumping on a plane to find your sperm donor. You watched a documentary, didn't you? And it was talking about the quality of sperm donations in Denmark.
Yes, in Denmark. And so therefore, that was the most I knew about sperm donation because I couldn't. Well, it was the only thing I'd ever watched. It was the only thing I knew. So suddenly my main source of information was this one documentary, and it all seemed fairly positive. And so I figured Denmark was as good a place as any. Because in England, we don't talk about sperm donation. We don't do sperm. We don't. It's not something that's a normal, quote-unquote, thing to do. And so our pool of donors over here to choose from is really small. In fact, I think, oh God, I don't want to say it because I'm not sure of the facts, but a sperm bank opened in England fairly recently and it shut pretty soon after because they didn't have enough donations given to them. And so I knew I had to go abroad, really, if I wanted a bigger pool to choose from. And so suddenly Denmark was, and a friend of mine's an embryologist and she was like, oh yeah, no, our clinic get most of their, donors from Denmark. So I was like, okay, fine. Someone in the industry also says Denmark, maybe I should look there initially because I didn't know where to start. I didn't know what to do. I had no idea what I was doing. So I needed a starting place, even if I then was going to change my mind or whatever. I needed somewhere to start, and it just happened to be that documentary.
And you know, in movies you see people like looking through catalogues and, you know, looking at men choosing physical, you know, personality features, but it's not like that, is it?
It's not like that at all, no, sadly. It's a bit like Tinder, I guess, in the fact that there's a shed, you put in what you want. So height, weight, nationality, blood type.
Strapping Danish Viking.
Yeah, yeah, ethnicity, that kind of thing. And it comes up with a list. But it is a list of, there's no photo or anything. It's a made-up name and then all of their stats. So, again, how much they weigh, what their job is. And at the beginning, I was looking as if it was a date, like, oh, he sounds cool, you know, but for a really long time, then you're like, what, Liv, what are you doing? Like, you're not going on a date with him. Means nothing that he sounds like a nice guy. And so eventually I started looking, because obviously my family is riddled with bad health. I started looking at their familial health, and you get up to their paternal and maternal grandparents, how they died, all of that kind of thing, and them siblings, their parents, if they've got any health issues. So you know a lot of information about them,
which is kind of weird, because if you were to meet a guy and have a baby with him, you don't know any of that information, do you?
You wouldn't know any of that.
Like quizzing a guy before you have sex with him, your grandparents, what did they die of?
It's so weird. But because you don't have the ability to procreate with them because you have a good time with them, you've got to pick another reason to choose them, as it were. And I went on health and then on whether they sounded like a nice person or, you know, and yeah.
I think that is important, though, because you want your kids to have nice person genes, right?
Yeah, and it may be that none of it comes down. You don't know what comes down through genetics into your kids, but I needed to, if I had the ability to choose, which I did, I needed to try and make sure, yeah, everything seemed good. Like, he didn't seem like a narcissistic prick or anything like that.
Yeah, no.
But it's overwhelming. Like, what are you looking for? Who knows? God knows. And no idea. Because what do you look for in DNA? And so, yeah, it had to come down to health, and then just a couple of things he said that clicked with me that I was like, oh yeah, okay, you sound nice.
He watches Game of Thrones.
He likes Home and Away, you know.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So you picked the donor, and then what was it? Was it IUI that you went through?
So I had IUI, which is really entry level 101 fertility treatment. So they put the sperm directly into your cervix, pretty much exactly the same as a smear test. So it takes the same amount of time as a smear test. It's as romantic as a smear test. But instead of scraping your cervix, they inject sperm.
I assumed that they put it right into your uterus.
No, they just shove it in, like, so you're literally in the treatment room for 5 or 6 minutes, if that.
Wow.
Legs in stirrups, and then they inject the sperm into your cervix. So it's entry level 101 basic infertility.
So it's not hugely invasive. I mean, did you have to go through all the injecting of hormones?
I opted not to, because as far as I was aware, I didn't have any fertility issues. My problem was the fact that I was single.
You didn't have the sperm.
So my body, as far as I knew, could have been as fertile as you like. So I didn't want to inject hormones into myself, etc., if I felt like I didn't need to do that. Initially, that was my starting point. I definitely would have done had it not have worked. And also, because cost-wise, I had to be quite clever with how I spent the money that I had in order to be able to get a baby. But then equally, if I'd have gone with IUI, assisted IUI, which is IUI with hormone drugs, it would have cost more, but the chances I'd have got pregnant were higher. And like IVF, that my chances would have been much higher if I'd have just gone straight to IVF. And my consultant wanted me to go straight to IVF because I'm old, I'm overweight.
I bet they did. Getting more money from you.
Yeah, all the statistics suggested that I should have gone straight to IVF in order to have a baby. But statistics are... I really struggle with statistics when it comes to fertility, because there is no one person that's exactly the same as me. Trying to have a baby with exactly the sperm that I chose, that time of the month, that, I don't know, whatever. All of those things have to go together for a statistic to be exactly the same as the next person that's doing IUI. So I know that there are trends in fertility, absolutely, But I think the statistics you've got to take with a massive pinch of salt, and don't let them scare you. It's just, it's really scaremongering. And like you say, bloody, the difference between IUI and IVF in cost and invasiveness on your body is frigging huge. And I would have gone to IVF, absolutely, but I wanted to start out. Like I say, I didn't think I had any problems. So why would I start at the highest? For me, that didn't feel right. But I get why some people do, like, let's get this out of the way, let's get it done, you know. And I get why, again, the scientists, consultant, is that they're scientists, aren't they? They want things to work out.
Yeah, they want success. You know, that's their job.
Of course they do. That is their job. So I get why they did it.
I think it's quite cynical of me to say they probably wanted the money. They wanted success. They wanted the best for their patients.
I think a bit of both, to be honest. It's an industry, and you know, the people within the industry forget that. But those of us using the industry very quickly begin to realize that it's an industry because of the sort of quick churning. You're at your most vulnerable when you're going through fertility treatment, whether you're single, in a partnership, whatever. You're vulnerable in that moment, and sometimes the care you get is not okay. And sometimes it's brilliant. You have to, you know, again, it's a magical freaking lottery.
It really is.
Fertility.
So, Liv, how did you feel when you found out that you were pregnant?
Overwhelmed. I couldn't believe it was happening to me. And even when I had him in my arms, I still couldn't believe that was happening to me. I couldn't believe I was finally that person that could talk about trimesters and how many weeks pregnant I was, and all of that I'd been longing for so much suddenly felt really real and really fucking terrifying, and all of those things. So, but again, I think that's the same whether you're single, have gone through fertility treatment, haven't gone through fertility treatment. I think being pregnant is overwhelming in so many ways, in brilliant ways and terrifying ways. And it's overwhelming.
And it's bonkers. You've got a human being growing inside your body.
Absolutely bonkers. That's got to get out, and then you've got to look after.
That's always the scary bit. I remember being pregnant thinking, this baby or these babies, when I had twins, they've got to get out somehow.
That became more... Actually, I became less worried about birth the further along I went, oddly, for me, because I'm the most anxious person in the world. So I assumed I'd be quite anxious about it. But actually, I sort of made peace with the fact that he had to come out.
Yeah. And what was the pregnancy like in terms of, like, did you grieve any kind of shared experience that you might have had with a partner? Or were you just...
Yeah, massively.
You did?
Massively. Yeah. And I grieved a life I thought I was going to have whilst I was going through fertility treatment as well. And I think that's why I found it quite so grueling, even though, like you say, my fertility treatment wasn't invasive at all. I found it really mentally grueling because I couldn't believe it had come to that for me, because I had spent 30 years assuming I'd have had a beautiful relationship and a lovely engagement, and you know, it'd all be hearts and roses like it had been for every other bugger I knew, you know, pinch of salt. And I had to grieve that a lot, and there were times when I was pregnant that was really acute, that kind of grief of someone going through it with me, like someone to hold my hand when I was sick. And Christ, I was sick. I was really poorly throughout my pregnancy, not just that lovely 12-week
period. Did you have hyperemesis gravidarum?
I didn't, actually, but I think I was very near to that. You know, my doctor had to constantly monitor me, but I was never dehydrated or hospital bound, but I was sick for the full 42 weeks. And yeah, so most of that time, I remember just thinking, Jesus Christ, not only have I not got anyone holding my hand, but all I wanted in the world was to be pregnant. And actually, it's the most horrific feeling I've ever felt.
Did you feel like you couldn't complain? Because people would be like, well, you wanted this.
Yeah, a little bit. And then I got over it. And I was like, I don't care. I don't care if they think that about me, because I feel like shit.
Oh, it's the worst feeling,
and
isn't it?
It's the worst. And it's just things like, you can't concentrate on anything, because all I was thinking about was, is there a bin near me that I can be sick in if I have to be sick? Where's the toilet wherever I am? Where, you know, that kind of, oh God, is that man walking past going to smell of aftershave? Because I will throw up in his shoes. And it was so visceral. It was quite, I didn't realise when people talked about morning sickness, how visceral it can be, how it's like, you're totally fine. And then something just triggers you and 15 milliseconds later, they're sick everywhere. It's like, it's just bonkers.
There's no dignity to it, is there?
None at all. And I kind of grieved having a partner. I grieved having a lovely pregnancy that I, you know, was going to be blooming and everything was going to be lovely and, you know, all that kind of mad shit you get fed. And that does happen for some people.
It does.
And I'm genuinely thrilled for those people, because good on them.
Yeah.
But also a lot of people think it's shit. And that's fine. And people need to know, if they feel shit, that that's okay. I remember Susie Verrill, when she was pregnant and she was so poorly with hyperemesis. And I remember just thinking, oh God, okay, people do get poorly. That is something that happens. Because before I hadn't acknowledged it, not because people didn't talk about it, but because I shielded myself from people who are pregnant, because I didn't want to know about their joy, even if they were talking about being sick. And I just remember thinking, oh, okay, that's cool. There are other people that feel shit. And obviously Susie, bless her, was a very extreme case.
She was.
But it made me feel less alone that it could happen, that people didn't feel great in pregnancy.
Yeah. And when it came to the birth, one of your sisters was your birth partner, wasn't she?
Well, both of my sisters and my best friend. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I got a full team in. Because I figured it was really unfair. If I had one sister, it would have been really unfair on her to take that pressure on. Because it's so intense. And so I had to have both sisters. And then my friend, again, because I thought if I was in there for a long time, I wouldn't want my sisters to just start feeling crap or feeling that it was too much for them. And I always think with things like that, the more the merrier. Just get everyone in.
It's got a party vibe in here.
Yeah, sod it. And yes, so they were all there for the full 900 days or whatever it was that I was in labour. Because, of course, my pregnancy went on until 42 weeks, because I wanted it to end at 40 weeks, you know, and you're like, come on, I don't want to feel this crap anymore. So of course it went on longer, and then I was induced, and so I think it was like over 40 hours of labour. So it was lucky there were three of them in there, because they could all sort of boost each other on and roll their eyes collectively at me at how ridiculous I was being when I was trying to count but couldn't, and pretending that I was doing hypnobirthing when I clearly wasn't. It was ridiculous.
And, you know, we talk a lot these days about the fourth trimester and how important it is for the mum to be resting and to be looked after just as much as the baby. What was your experience of that, of those first few weeks?
I'm a little bit now, I'm a bit evangelical about the fourth trimester and mum's resting. And whenever I see new mums out, you know, in a pub when their baby's 4 days old or whatever, I'm just like, oh my God, can you all go back to bed and sleep, please? You know? And of course, they might be happy as clowns out there, but I just don't want them to feel that pressure of, oh, we're out, baby's first outing. Like, just go back to bed, just go back to bed.
I have the same reaction. I almost feel like a bit sick inside for them. And I know that that is purely me and my own feelings.
Absolutely, because I needed to be in bed.
You wouldn't have coped well sitting in a pub with a 4-day-old baby, and neither would I. So we have that kind of like feeling.
I have that, and they're probably having a bloody lovely time, but I have this visceral urge to go and hug them and get them, cocoon them back into a nice, for the love of God, go and have some chicken soup. But I was bloody lucky. Like, I had my sisters there 24/7 for 2 or 3 weeks. And I found it so tough, like unbelievably tough. It hit me like a ton of bricks. I'd been so consumed with getting pregnant and so consumed with being a mum that I hadn't actually ever wondered what being a mum meant in that first, you know, few weeks especially. And I felt like I'd been hit by a truck, and I didn't have that maternal kick that I thought I'd have, that I assumed I'd have.
Well, because you'd had it, you'd had it since you were 12.
Because I'd been having, and I'd been so maternal to everyone else. Suddenly I had my longed for beautiful baby. Actually, he wasn't beautiful at all. He was so unattractive. And this, and I just didn't have that need to nurture him, and I just wanted to sleep. I think I was in so much trauma from the birth, which was pretty traumatic, that I just needed to sleep and recover to then be able to focus on him. And actually, when he was maybe, again, I'm really bad with, I'd say 3 weeks old, my sister said, do you want me to take him away for the night? And I was like, yep. She was like, really, do you? I was like, no, definitely, yes, please, could you? And she was a bit worried at that stage, like, oh God, this doesn't sound good.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because like, we're fed this kind of idea of what new motherhood should be like, and it is that intense, immediate bond with the baby, and you know, not wanting to be separated from them. And that isn't the reality.
I really wanted to be separated.
But that's the thing, that's not the reality for so many, is it? No. Some mums, like you say, need to heal themselves before they're strong enough to then be like, right, okay, now let's crack on with bonding and spending time with the baby.
And learning how to be a mum. And so when my sister took him, I got home, I went to sleep for something like 16 hours and woke up. She came about half an hour after I woke up with him, and I was absolutely thrilled he was back. And that's when I knew that it was all going to be okay, that I had just needed rest and I had just needed time away to sort of regroup. And again, I know that some people, just like my niece has just had a baby, and I know that she would not consider anyone else taking her babe away for less than 24 hours when he was that old. But for me, it was the most healing thing I could have done. And it felt amazing when he came back, because that's when I knew everything was going to be okay. And yeah, I think it's really important for people to know that it is really tricky. You can feel like you're not bonding with them, and that's fine. Loads of people feel like that. Loads of people don't. Loads of people do get that motherhood jolt. But don't panic if you don't get it. Or ask for help. You know, there's so much help out there, and people won't laugh at you. People won't think you're a bad mother or a bad person. Or if your thoughts are getting dark or scary, or ask a professional for help. Speak to anybody and they'll be able to help you. But the likelihood is it will all be fine, and you will get that urge to look after the babe. And now I'm bloody obsessed with him. Jesus Christ. I look at photos of him when he's asleep. And, you know, and it does change. And I'd like to tell myself that when I was, you know, 2 days into motherhood, that in 3.5 years' time, you're going to be obsessed with that kid. Don't you worry about it. It's fine. Well, not even 3.5 years.
I'll tell you what,
much less than that. But
when time travel becomes available, that will be, yes, I think, one of the most useful ways to, yep, use it, is to be able to go back in time and tell your new mum self something reassuring. I mean, how, yes, good would that be?
That would have been amazing. It would have made it all feel so much better. Mm. And then, of course, as soon as I sort of got my shit together and knew that everything was okay and started feeling normal, and that I kind of knew what I was doing and we had a little routine and we got on, I had to go back to work when he was 4 months old, you know, because there's no one else bringing in any money. The massive mortgage that I created in order to get him had to get paid somehow, you know, and so that again was really tough. And again, I went through a period of kind of grief of, I should be having a lovely year off that my nice husband's paying for, you know, that kind of mad thing that you think other people are going through, and they're probably not.
I mean, I wouldn't class it as a year off, Liv.
No, actually, you know what I mean. But that's, God, no, actually, there are many, many times I'd much rather have been at work. But that kind of pressure of that, a monetary year off, I think, maybe.
Yeah,
is the,
no, absolutely.
You know, yeah, it's just all this bullshit you think other people are going through and that's perfect. And it just isn't. No one's got it perfect. No one's got it right. You know, you have to muddle on through to get the life you want and to make it work for you and your team.
Absolutely.
Because that's the only thing you can do.
And you mentioned earlier that there are things that you would do differently if you did it all again. What are some of those things?
I would save more money. No questions asked. I would look into, this is a bit tricky, but I would try and look into what clinic to use with slightly more depth than I did, which was Googling clinics and going to the first one, because they weren't the right fit for me. And they made, whenever I think about fertility treatment, I don't feel excited. I don't have any nice memories of it. There was nothing I enjoyed about it because they were such a bad fit for me that I felt like I was on a conveyor belt.
Yeah.
And, you know, they would phone like 6 months after treatment and say, was it successful? Your treatment, was it successful?
Oh.
And you're just like, are you kidding? I've only just got my head around things. Or, and then, oh, okay. Well, do you want to pencil in a date to try again?
Oh, my goodness.
And you're like, are you kidding me? And looking back, it was so bad. But I know that some people have loved that clinic that I went to. So it's a very personal thing. I could never name and shame a clinic because they're great for some people. Just for me, they weren't at all. And a lot of clinics do open days, and I should have looked further.
It's hard though, right?
That.
Because you don't know what,
I mean, I didn't know
you
what,
don't
I was
what
looking
you're looking for.
Yeah.
You know,
haven't been
through it. You don't know what the possible experiences are.
No. But equally, you do get that kind of feeling, don't you? It's like when you go looking around schools or whatever, and you, no, I have no idea what I'm looking for HERP. But if people smile at me and they've got a nice, kind face, I'm like, oh, okay, you look like you'd be kind. And that's the thing. I just didn't do any of that. I would change definitely, because I think my experience would have been so much better had it have been at another clinic.
So in terms of advice for someone who's listening, who is perhaps, you know, thinking about doing something similar, is that the advice you would give them to really research fertility clinics?
My top advice would be to save every penny. Never buy a coffee again, ever. Buy yourself a coffee machine. And then every time you would have gone into wherever you get your coffee and spend £6 on coffee and a whatever, put that into a savings account.
I remember seeing that in like women's magazines about 15 years ago. It was like, if you kick your coffee habit, you can buy these expensive Gucci shoes. Well, instead, you can pay for this.
yeah. So that would always be my main thing. And also to, like I said earlier, to not beholden to fertility statistics. There are always outliers. There are trends, absolutely. And yes, your fertility does decline after a certain age, but your internal organs do not blow up at midnight on your 35th birthday. Like, you can still reproduce after 35. You will be called geriatric, but you just roll your eyes at that. And miracles do happen. A friend of mine this week, she tried to get pregnant for 8 years and eventually had a baby with her best friend, a surrogate. And then they had a healthy boy via, like I say, her best friend was her surrogate for her. And she's found out that she's pregnant.
Wow.
You know, miracles do happen with fertility. So don't let statistics scare you into, like I say, my clinic wanted me to go straight to IVF, but I really didn't. And I'm really glad that I was strong enough to say no, because I did manage to do it without IVF. And for me, that, if nothing else financially, that was better for me. So that would be my one thing.
Brilliant. Liv, a massive thank you for being my guest.
You're so welcome.
Liv's Alone, Amateur Adventures in Solo Motherhood, is available to buy now. It's been so lovely to have a natter with you.
Thank you.
Where can people find you online to hear more from you and to see the delicious herb as well?
He is pretty delicious, which is annoying because he gets away with murder. Well, because I'm really interesting, my book and my Instagram handle are the same thing. So my Instagram is Lives Alone and my book is Lives Alone.
It's because you've got a strong brand, Liv.
I mean, it is pretty cool. I'm quite proud of myself for that. But I wanted to call the book Spunked, but my publisher wouldn't let me. I think it would have been Ace. But anyway... Next time, maybe
next time.
I'm never writing another book. But
That can be your podcast.
Yeah, okay, sure, that'll do.
Liv, thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's been so good.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Okay, bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.